This program is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Ford Foundation.
Hello, I'm Michelle Norris, and this is Every Voice and Sing, a look at the choral music legacy of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities of the United States.
Oh, Jesus is a rock in a weary land, a weary land, a weary land. Jesus is a rock in a weary land.
In this episode, And Sing, we'll look at the development and changes in black choral music, how it was influenced by college-based and professional choirs, as well as directors and composers. We'll also examine how certain artists, venues, and social changes in America affected the music and its acceptance.
I'll tell you the reason why I'm afraid my Lord might call my name.
Jesus is a rock in a weary land, a weary land, a weary land.
Jesus is a rock
in a weary land, a shelter in the time of a storm.
A decade or so after the first triumphant tours of the Fisk and Hampton Jubilee Singers, some educated blacks and many college students saw the singing of Negro spirituals as a painful reminder of the degradations under slavery. Dr. Linda Kershaw is director-conductor of the concert choir, and she's associate professor of music at Benedict College in South Carolina.
I'm sure that the distaste of the servitude represented in the spirituals was a part of that reason, to not want to have to remember and perpetuate the memory of such a terrible, tragic time in our people's history in this country.
The drive to prove that they were as intellectually and artistically equal to whites often led many blacks to overly imitate and pattern themselves after white society. But the spirituals were folk songs crafted in the dialect of enslaved blacks in the South. Few black college students wanted to sing songs with negative connotations and improper pronunciations. Dr. James Arthur Williams is a choral conductor. He taught at Stillman College and Wilberforce University for more than 30 years.
Good or bad, we have a song for everything. So the slave had a song for everything. He had what people criticize as his cornfield ditties and field songs, but he also had these songs that we call spirituals, the songs that he had written. And not literally written, but that he had made up for this new God that he worshipped. And to express his faith in and affection for this new God. You have blacks who objecting to maintaining this negative thing of all of these old slave songs and cornfield ditties and things that they believed degraded and demeaned black folk. And there were others who appreciated the artistry.
Yes, one of these days. One of these days. Yes, one of these days. One of these days. Oh, yes, he will reign. One of these days.
From the late 1890s through the early 1900s, students often balked at singing spirituals. At Fisk, at Hampton, and there was even a rebellion.
The rebellion of the Howard University students in 1899 against singing Negro spirituals.
Dr. Horace Boyer is Professor Emeritus of African American Music and Music Theory at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Because it boxed them in and they thought that they were a little bit more worldly than that. And among some colleges there was that feeling that we sing the Bach Smash in B minor now. And that prevailed.
And not just at Howard, Fisk, and Hampton. Dr. Carl Smith is the director of choral activities at Kentucky State University.
The spiritual, as we sing it today, was not the way they sang it then. Now, we try to capture the spirit, but we are probably more in the line of Europeanism along with that spiritual than we were at the time. Why do I say that? Because, first of all, the spiritual is an outgrowth of people who were not trained musicians. And the singing was simply from the heart, from the soul, and from the musical experiences that they already had. And, they weren't trained. You know, they weren't Marian Andersons and William Warfields at that time. They had those voices, but they had a different kind of delivery.
But the HBCUs, including schools like Kentucky State and Benedict, were training those new student voices to not only sing the spirituals, but to also focus on and master that European classical style. Kentucky State University was founded in the 1860s Reconstruction era. Dr. Smith.
But a number of land-grant universities were established. And Kentucky State has been in existence since that time. Of course, it was not Kentucky State University then. I think the first name was Kentucky State College, normal school for colored persons.
Its choral history is steeped in spirituals and the European choral tradition. As Dr. Smith sees it, that's the basic root of the music.
And that combination of European harmonic tendency and the spiritual, rhythmic, and improvisational context was very obvious. So we have this spiritual thing, this different kind of music that comes together and creates this beautiful spiritual that we have.
My musical life in choral music has been so entrenched in spirituals that I hope nothing ever causes us to lose that part of our history.
Benedict Choir Director Linda Kershaw knows and understands the history of the music.
I do realize that shortly after emancipation and after the Fisk Jubilee Singers tours, by the time we got into the early 20s, black college choirs were focusing on Western European music.
Benedict College was no exception.
Benedict College was founded in 1870 in the same tradition of most historically black colleges, shortly after emancipation, by the American Home Mission.
Its original mission was to prepare newly emancipated slaves for careers as teachers and preachers.
At that time, it was called Benedict Institute. By 1891, it became Benedict College. And there were 31 students taking music courses in that year.
By 1910, Benedict, like other historically black colleges and universities, had a traveling choir.
And there were 35 women and men singing at that time. So I would say officially as a choral unit, 1910 are where our records show that we had a performing choir outside of the college campus.
Dr. Horace Boyer on the growth and development of these choirs.
Now, the choirs between 1900 and 1930 had its period of identity and full development. We began to get a group of men and women who were educated in music. They had studied music, and the strange thing was in that period, if you studied music, you studied European music. You studied Bach. You studied Brahms. And what you had to do was you had to take your knowledge from Bach and Brahms and apply it to Plenty Good Room in My Father's Kingdom and Swing Low Sweet Child.
Or Go Down Moses.
God bless all.
They took that knowledge and said, here's this spiritual. I think I can arrange it in four parts, teach it to my choir like the art songs of Brahms and Schubert, and they published them.
Arrangers and composers like R. Nathaniel Dett at Hampton, William Levi Dawson at Tuskegee, and John W. Work Jr. and his son, John W. Work III, at Fisk.
Keep your hand on the plow, hold on, hold on.
John W. Work Jr. was born in 1871 in Nashville, Tennessee. He attended Fisk University, where he studied Latin and history. When he became a Latin and Greek instructor there, Work became a leader in the movement to preserve, study, and perform Negro spirituals. He organized Fisk University singing groups and, with the help of his brother, Frederick, collected and harmonized songs and spirituals. Go Tell It on the Mountain and other favorites can be found in his seminal collections, New Jubilee Songs and Folk Song of the American Negro. Ethnomusicologist Dr. Carl Smith.
My most significant experience with the spiritual was when I heard the Fisk Jubilee singers sing as a youngster under the direction of John Work. And they had costumes, long dresses, so forth and so on. The guys were very, you know, handsome looking in their tuxedos. But what impressed me was every time they finished the song, there was applause. There was no pitch back, there was nothing. And they start singing.
Well, my brother, hold on. Yes, you gotta hold on.
Yes, just keep your hand on the plow.
Everybody sang together. Right on. Different chord, different key. Knew exactly where they were.
Just keep your hand on the
plow.
Hold on.
Yes, you
just hold on.
If that plow stays in your hand and straight in the promised land,
just keep your hand on the plow. Hold on.
Yes, you
just hold on.
Will my sister hold on?
Hold on.
They were actually led by John Work III, who admirably followed in his father's footsteps. The younger Work began his own training at Fisk University and earned additional degrees at Columbia and Yale. But Big John, as he was fondly known to members of the Fisk Jubilee Singers he directed, had begun composing while still in high school. He continued to compose, arrange, and conduct throughout his career, even while chairman of the music department at Fisk University. But he did much more. He and his predecessors and contemporaries touched people's lives, students, and audiences.
John W. Work, that we used to call Big John. You heard me sing at the Omega Contest in Kingston, North Carolina in 1950, and he asked me to come to Fisk.
This is Every Voice and Sing. I'm Michelle Norris. We caught up with George H. Adams, a 1956 graduate of Fisk and former Fisk Jubilee singer under John Work III, at the end of a Fisk Jubilee Singers concert in New York's Riverside Church in March of 2006.
And he asked me to come to Fisk. So I went and was lucky enough to be the first tenor soloist for the group. The group of 1956 went back to Europe under John Work. And that was the first group from the college that went back to Europe from the original, okay? And that was a hell of an experience. And there wasn't one place that we had a concert that it wasn't packed. They were sitting in the aisle or sitting around the stage. And the last concert that we gave in Rome, I tell you, we couldn't get out of there. I thought they were going to keep us hostage. Really, they didn't want to let us go, right? But it was a good experience.
A college experience that lasted a lifetime, thanks to a legendary choral conductor and caring human being, Dr. James Arthur Williams.
We owe a lot to those persons who took the time and the energy to write and arrange the music of the Slave. They were the ones who really helped us to preserve it. A man like William Dawson, who graduated from a music school in Kansas City where he could not even go and receive his diploma, but went on to Tuskegee and had a way of listening to the students from various parts of the South and just write down what they sang naturally in their homes, in their communities, and arrange them. Writing these things, they had to make them acceptable to white publishers. We didn't have the big publishing houses. And even when we perform them now, we have to make sure that they maintain their ethnicity and that they maintain it as black music. Because it's possible to look at Dawson's Ain't It That Good News and sing it like an English madrigal. But we have to understand and make sure that it's performed in its own genre.
William Dawson was born in Anniston, Alabama. He ran away from home at the age of 13 to attend Tuskegee Institute. He supported himself as a manual laborer in order to complete his education there in 1921. He had advanced degrees from the Horner Institute of Fine Arts in Kansas City, Missouri, and the American Conservatory of Music. He organized the School of Music at Tuskegee in 1931. His composition, The Negro Folk Symphony, premiered in 1934 with the Philadelphia Orchestra under the direction of Leopold Stokowski. For 25 years, Dawson conducted the 100-voice Tuskegee Choir.
Thank you. one thing that Mr. Dawson did.
Dr. Henry Bradford is an ordained minister who was a chaplain. He also worked with the male chorus, quartet, and glee club at Leland College in Baker, Louisiana.
Going over the country, acquainting people with the spirituals in a perhaps more sophisticated fashion.
Not everyone was pleased with the artful, more sophisticated interpretations. According to an interview with former slave Squire Dow in the WPA Slave Narratives,
those are the same old tunes, but some way they don't sound right.
Nell Bradford is a retired choir director, having served for more than 40 years combined at Leland College and Alabama A&M University.
And all of the arrangements of spirituals back in the day were arrangements of Dawson. And the high school choirs sang them, and college choirs sang them all over the country. He made any number of recordings of his choir singing his own arrangements of spirituals. So I think he was very outstanding in that area.
In 1932, the Tuskegee Choir was one of the main attractions at the grand opening of the Radio City Music Hall in New York City.
Easy go, son, way up in the middle of the air. Easy go, son, easy go, son, way in the middle of the air.
The big wheel run by faith, and the little wheel run by grace of God. And we will in our wheel, way in the middle of the air.
They were transported from Tuskegee to New York in a private railroad car as the guests of John D. Rockefeller, Dr. Williams.
They were held over for weeks, held over for weeks. Wonderful opportunity to spread this music. And this is why I pointed out Mr. Dawson as one of those persons who was really instrumental in spreading the spiritual across the world.
Some go to church for the singing. Some go to church for the singing. Shout, hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
As we've indicated before, the black colleges were almost an extended family. These college composer-conductors knew and respected each other's work. Even in the late 1960s, William L. Dawson was guest conductor for the Talladega Concert Choir and the Mobile Symphony Orchestra as they performed R. Nathaniel Dett's oratorio, The Ordering of Moses. It's a classical piece rooted in the spiritual Go Down Moses.
Nathaniel Dett, he had the best of training. He went to France. He studied with Nadia Boulanger, which everybody wanted to study with. He was a fantastic composer.
Dr. Lena McLinn is a minister, author, musician, and classical composer.
It was a work that was just fantastic. And then ENBC came up and commissioned him to write a great work. He was just a fantastic genius.
Thank you.
Born in Ontario, Canada, Det is remembered most for combining the music of the European Romantics with the Negro spiritual. His many arrangements and compositions include Listen to the Lambs and The Chariot Jubilee.
He stayed at Hampton, I think, about 18 years. And then he left from Hampton and went to several other colleges. And wherever he went, he took that knowledge and put it there.
He resigned the Hampton Institute choral director's position in 1933, but in addition to stints at other HBCUs, he also served as the choral conductor for Stromberg Carlson's NBC radio broadcasts. This appointment was a reflection of just how wide and deep black choral music, especially the spirituals, had penetrated America, and how it would continue to spread across not just the country, but the world between the 1930s and the 1950s. Mrs. Nell Bradford.
You had arrangements of Harry T. Burley, Hall Johnson, Wendell Whalum, choir director at Morehouse College for any number of years.
Harry T. Burley studied under Anton Dvorak at the National Conservatory of Music in New York City, where he later taught.
Harry T. Burley is so enthralled with the work of the spiritual, and being a fantastic operatic singer himself, he takes this work and prepares it.
Dr. Lena McLinn.
And makes people realize that it is a work of art. So it's no longer just a spiritual. It is an art song. It's just like the art songs of the 17th century in Europe. But in America, that art song belonged on the concert stage. And so Harry T. Burley put that spiritual on the concert stage. And now the great singers of opera, classical, could also include this spiritual as an art song.
To hear the sin-sick soul, if you can preach like Peter, if you can pray like Paul, go home and tell your neighbor, he died.
He was a prolific arranger. His works for solo voice were so popular during the 1920s and 1930s that almost no vocal recitalist gave a concert in a major city without occasionally singing them. He's most renowned for the arrangement of Deep River, an arrangement he did for the outstanding singer and actor Paul Robeson.
Deep river.
The son of a former slave, Robeson was born in 1898. He excelled in sports, drama, academics, singing, and debating. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Rutgers University as the third black in the history of the school, and he went on to complete a law degree at Columbia University in 1923. A white secretary in the law firm where he was employed refused to take dictation from him. Robeson resigned, and he turned to his other love, the stage.
I want to cross over into Cameron.
He was soon starring on Broadway in Eugene O'Neill's All God's Children Got Wings. He is perhaps most remembered for his show-stopping rendition of Old Man River in the original Broadway production of Showboat.
You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge and lift that bale, you show a little grit and you land. Instead of crying, I must keep fighting until I'm dying. And Old Man River, he'll just keep rolling along. He
made 11 Hollywood films, but he was also known for his love of Negro spirituals.
Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I will pray.
When I sing my spirituals, in which is the whole history of my race, it is then, more than at any other time, that I am liable to be caught away and feel and know that God exists and God is love.
Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I pray.
The two spirituals for which he's most remembered are Go Down Moses and, of course, Deep River, arranged by Harry T. Burley. Thanks to Burley and others, the music was everywhere. Again, Dr. Henry Bradford.
Frederick Hall, he really was interested in singing spirituals in quartet fashion. He published a book of Negro spirituals just for male quartet. And he found that it was a very effective way to get the spiritual across.
Gotta fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Gotta fit the battle of Jericho when the walls come tumbling down. That morning, gotta fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Gotta fit the battle of Jericho when the walls come tumbling down. Good morning, brother pilgrim. Pray tell me where you're bound. Pray tell me where you're traveling to on this enchanted ground. My name it is Bold Pilgrim. Canaan I am bound, to Canaan I am traveling to on this enchanted ground.
This is Every Voice and Sing. I'm Michelle Norris.
Georgia fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Georgia fit the battle of Jericho.
Frederick Hall's seminal Dillard University student quartet traveled widely. Eventually known as the Delta Rhythm Boys, they were nationally and internationally acclaimed, especially in South America. They had a wide-ranging repertoire.
Ezekiel connected them, dry bones. Ezekiel connected them, dry bones. Ezekiel connected them, dry bones. Now hear the word of the Lord.
The music was on international and national concert stages, college concert performances, regular national radio broadcasts.
All right, Ralph.
Four great cars, Plymouth, Dodge, DeSoto, and Chrysler, present to you Major Edward Bowes and his original Amateur Hour. Major?
Thank you, Ralph, and good evening, friends.
Even Broadway and Hollywood came calling. Dr. James Arthur Williams.
They just feel that if you have all these black people in a movie, there must be some singing. And if there isn't some singing, there's something wrong.
Eva Jesse and Hall Johnson answered Hollywood's call.
When you look at Green Pastures, it's full of singing. And many of the great popular spirituals, you know, that, you know, hallelujah, those kinds of things are included. And so they went to get, I would imagine at that time, the best they could find to be authentic in the singing of the spirituals. So they would get Hall Johnson.
Oh, walk together till long.
Don't skip me.
Walk together till long.
Don't skip me.
Walk together till long.
Don't skip me. That's a great campaign in the promised land.
Walk all together till long.
Don't skip me.
Walk together till long.
Don't skip me.
Walk together till long.
Don't skip me. That's a great campaign in the promised land.
Frances Hall Johnson, born in 1888, was a highly regarded African-American choral director, composer, arranger, and violinist. He dedicated his career to preserving the integrity of the Negro spiritual as it had been performed during the era of slavery. His Hall Johnson Choir debuted in New York City in 1926, the first professional group of its kind. It enjoyed a successful concert and recording career for more than three decades in the U.S. and abroad. Hall Johnson graduated with a bachelor's degree in music from the University of Pennsylvania in 1910. He played in the dance orchestra of Vernon and Irene Castle. He toured the country, playing blues, folk, and popular music, and he was a member of the orchestra for the Broadway production of Noble Sissel and U.B. Blake's Shuffle Along and its sequel, Runnin' Wild. As a Broadway pit musician, he heard performances of spirituals presented with white barbershop harmonies. Johnson knew what the true sound should be. He wanted to recapture what he'd heard as a child when those Negro spirituals were sung by his mother and his grandmother. Both women had been slaves. He ultimately formed the eight-voice Hall Johnson Choir. They soon became one of the most impressive musical groups in that explosion of arts and culture that has now become known as the Harlem Renaissance.
Above,
National attention came in 1930 when the choir performed under Johnson's direction using his arrangements in the original Broadway production of the musical Green Pastures. In 1935, Johnson took the choir to California to participate in the film version of Green Pastures. He remained in California to appear in many films, including Hearts Divided, Lost Horizon, Dumbo, Tales of Manhattan, and Cabin in the Sky. In that film, the great singer and actress Ethel Waters sang,
"Seem like happiness is just a thing called gel. He got a smile that make the lilac wanna grow. He got a way that make the angels heave a sigh when they know little Joe's passing by. Sometime the cabin gloomy and the table bare. Soon he kiss me and it's Christmas everywhere."
Again, Dr. Williams on the Hollywood search for authenticity.
They would get Eva Jessie.
A legend in her own time, Eva Jessie was born in Coffeyville, Kansas, on January 20, 1895. She attended Western University and Langston University, receiving a B.A. in 1919. Jessie spent time teaching in the segregated Oklahoma and Baltimore school systems before moving to New York City in 1922. While working as a journalist in New York City, she became the choir conductor for several gospel groups. In 1926, Jessie organized the original Dixie Jubilee Singers and performed regularly on radio shows such as the Major Bowes Family Radio Hour and the General Motors Hour. In 1929, Hollywood director King Vidor hired her for his all-black film, Hallelujah. That's when she changed the group's name to the Eva Jessie Choir. Dr. Lena McLinn.
Here you have this conductor, director, whatever you want to call him, who comes along and gives Eva and I've forgotten that man.
That man was no doubt Harry T. Burleigh. The credits for the film Hallelujah now list Henry Thacker Burleigh, musical arranger. Eva Jessie is listed as the musical director.
They all were pros, and they took that and made that movie for the director, made the movie. The director didn't make that movie. Those two people made that movie. The music was everywhere, and everybody quite enjoyed it. See, they would love to be entertained by it, you know.
Splitting her professional career between New York City and Hollywood, Eva Jessie became the original conductor for George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, a work that's always been controversial. It was an opera composed by the son of a Jewish cantor and based on the book Porgy by white South Carolina novelist DuBose Hayward. It's a story about lower-class blacks on the Charleston waterfront. As Dr. Boyer confirms, it reflected the dual strains of the HBCU choral tradition mentioned earlier by Dr. Carl Smith. First, the European classical stylings and harmonies, and also the rhythmic syncopation, dialect, and other Africanisms found in the Negro spiritual.
Now, I'll tell you, had it not been for the concert tradition, I would never have heard of... I got a chance to sing part of Porgy and Bess in the 50s when I was in high school in Florida.
Without knowing it, Gershwin's Porgy and Bess also forced us to examine the inherent duality described by African-American writer, activist, and social critic W.E.B. Du Bois.
African-Americans, faced with the conflicts of their double identity, both American and African, with two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals, and one dark body.
I think it goes back to the part where we hadn't learned yet to appreciate who we were and what we could create.
Some of that psychological confusion could easily be explained. Even as African Americans were being almost lionized on concert stages, movie screens, and radio programs, many of their communities were being burned and razed to the ground. Lynchings were at an all-time high, and Jim Crow segregation was expanding across the country. As a result, one of two highly talented musical brothers helped found a national organization designed to agitate for the legal rights and protection of blacks in the U.S. It was called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP. That founding member was James Weldon Johnson, his brother, J. Rosamond Johnson. Together, they wrote what became known as the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Born in Jacksonville, Florida during the 1870s to a musical family, James became a school principal, Rosamond a music teacher. James wrote the words, Rosamond the music. It was by far the best-known work the brothers created. It was originally written as a poem, then set to music to celebrate Abraham Lincoln's birthday in 1900. On that occasion, it was performed by a chorus of 500 school children. Whether sung by untrained school children, professional chorales, or HBCU choirs, it's stirring music and ringing declaration of purpose and resolve, always seems to move and inspire any audience, any time, any place. I'm Michelle Norris. Thank you for joining us.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, and, in part, by support from Jazz 88.3 FM, WBGO Radio, in Newark, New Jersey. Every Voice and Sing is a production of EVT Educational Productions. Host and narrator, Michelle Norris. Writer-producers, Ann S. Hayward and Eric V. Tate, Jr. Audio design and engineering, Duke Marcos. Technical producers, Jonathan Blakely, David Tallickson, and Stephen A. Weiss. Researchers, Jackie Farmer and Lynn James. Production associates, Elizabeth Jarvis and Lobe Redhawk. Additional musical underscoring composed, arranged, and performed by Onaje Allen Gums. Additional voices, Andre Solomon Glover, Raymond Peterson, and Chris Swan. Advisors, Dr. Roland Carter, the Ruth S. Holmberg Professor of American Music at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and Dr. James Arthur Williams, choral conductor and educator, now retired. Audio consultant, Don Alameda. In-kind services provided by the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, Newark, New Jersey. Our thanks to the following vocal groups: the Benedict College Concert Choir, the Fisk Jubilee Singers, the Heritage Signature Chorale, the Kentucky State University Concert Choir, and the Tuskegee University Concert Choir. Special thanks to Cephas Bowles, Thurston Briscoe, Nicole Franklin, Keith Gonzalez, Louise Merriweather, and Jonathan Weaver. The executive producer of Every Voice and Sing is Eric V. Tate, Jr. For more information about this series and the choral music legacy of the historically black colleges and universities, visit us at www.evted.org.